What's the 101 and the Bitcoin 101 answer for like why does the 21 million coins stay intact? And in other words, like the supply schedule that is public and transparent, how do we actually know it won't change, or what keeps it from changing? The advanced answer is go study, look at the BCAP project. And yeah, we just talked about some simpler answers to get people, to get their curiosity going. I was just going to say a couple of related topics that I know we were considering talking about. One is another holiday topic is always custody. Like, should, you know, especially, well, actually, this spans from people new to Bitcoin own a little bit of Bitcoin, or advanced users. You know, do you buy an ETF? Do you buy it on Coinbase and store it on Coinbase? Do you self-custody? And there's a wide variety of options there. So that's related to the 21 million, because if you take it to the extreme and everyone just bought the BlackRock ETF and like literally all the Bitcoin was held by BlackRock, well, then the 21 million is in jeopardy. And in fact, one of the topics we had here is 21 million not guaranteed. And that's an actual disclaimer by BlackRock.
Spicy.
Which riled up a bunch of Bitcoiners. So we can talk about that as well. It's related. So maybe we just jump into that.
Yeah, let's do that.
So I forget exactly where it's stated on BlackRock, but I'm almost positive it's just some, you know, a group of lawyers making sure they have that legal disclaimer, because the reality is that it's not a guarantee that the 21 million cannot change. BlackRock certainly cannot guarantee that. So I suspect their lawyers are like, well, you know, BlackRock's not in control of this. So we need to have this legal disclaimer. So I actually view it as like a good thing, in the sense that like they're admitting we don't control this thing, but the conspiracy upon conspiracy take on this is that they're preparing a change to Bitcoin consensus rules, and that they'll control enough Bitcoin and have enough power that they'll be able to change that in the future, which is important to always be mindful of. We absolutely need to be monitoring that, whether it's Michael Saylor or BlackRock or the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve by the United States or whatever. And so it's very important that we're always actively thinking about this, monitoring it, discussing the game theory. But
do you have a sense of at what point you'd start to get worried about it? Like I think Saylor's just over 2% right now. Is that problematic as it is, or is it like it? You'd prefer that nobody has anywhere over 1%, or how do you think about where it starts to really get in the danger zone?
I don't really know. And it is also, I don't think it's just like some number that's applied to any type of entity. I think it depends on the entity. So like one of the insights from the BCAP project is that, there's a clear difference between someone who's self-custodying versus like a Michael Saylor MicroStrategy situation versus BlackRock. So if it's just an individual who owns 100,000 Bitcoin or some massive amount of Bitcoin, they self-custody, they can obviously act with speed and full control. They don't need to ask anyone permission on spending that Bitcoin, trading it. In the event of some future chain split or fork where there's two coins produced, they can immediately act on that and trade on that, sell one, buy the other. They can also play havoc with markets just by dumping coins and pumping and playing games like that. And so someone with a whale with self-custody, I think, has the most power there. And then I'd say the second most powerful situation would be like the MicroStrategy one, where there's more than one person involved. I mean, MicroStrategy has lawyers, they have a board of directors, they're a publicly listed company. So there's way more like guardrails in place than a whale. But I think it's pretty clear Michael Saylor calls the shots there. So he could likely act swiftly and with his own prejudice. And in both those scenarios, like whether it's the whale who's on their own or Michael Saylor, like their own philosophy on what Bitcoin is, what it should be, could play a role in what they do with the coins too. But the BlackRock situation is, to me, less of a threat in the sense that they don't currently even, they don't own the Bitcoin. Their shoulders own the Bitcoin. And they also don't currently control the Bitcoin. Coinbase does. Now that could change. BlackRock could take custody of the coin. So we can't rely on that. But I think BlackRock is a situation where another huge difference between BlackRock and MicroStrategy. BlackRock, Bitcoin is just a tiny percentage of their overall business. Whereas MicroStrategy is all about Bitcoin. It's like an all-in bet. So with BlackRock, they're highly unlikely to do something controversial with Bitcoin, try to change the rules or sell one fork and double down another as a first mover, because they would face massive legal repercussions. It could literally risk their entire business. They're gonna be conservative, I think.
Not worth it. I want to add one other point for context there. Two points for context. The first is, when you think about what percentage of the network or what percentage of the coins you need to own to really be able to influence that shift, I think it's also interesting to think about, like, in 2017, right? Like, whales like Roger Ver, how much did Ver own? I would assume way more than BlackRock, probably more than MicroStrategy. I don't know if he ever got that high, maybe similar holdings, 1-2%. I don't know if that's like a known fact, but obviously he wasn't able to move the markets with that much on Bcash. So I think it's really important, for one thing, that, you know, we have a lot of the early whales that are still involved and still have some of the original principles. I would start to get concerned if some of the early whales, for example, maybe got, I don't know, shift in their philosophy and aligned with too many of the newcomers like BlackRock and potential governments. But I think that's one of the beauty of Bitcoin is we don't even know who a lot of the early whales are. Some are well known, some are super, super private. And I think as long as they're there, you know, in this generation, I think we're probably in decent hands. I kind of think that, like, my base case is that at some point, I don't know if it's BlackRock, MicroStrategy, U.S. government, U.S. government potentially acquisitioning their coins, which I think is a very interesting topic and something I do think will happen at some point. But I think someone's going to try, just like they did with S2X, and it's going to fail, just like it did last time, assuming, you know, people are very vigilant, people keep running nodes. What I'm more concerned about, and what I think is more realistic, is over many generations. I think what's more likely to happen is Bitcoin lasts many generations. Eventually, people will forget why they were running nodes in the first place. I mean, if you don't really fight to keep it easy to run personal nodes and keep custody, self-custody very easy, then I think, you know, three generations down the line, that's when you could execute a successful attack.
Let me challenge that a little bit. I think advising people to just run nodes, I think that's like negligible impact. It doesn't really help defend anything. Like if I run Bitcoin, because if I run Bitcoin Core on my laptop right now, and it's just sitting here running all day long, like, that doesn't defend Bitcoin at all. If you're running a node, you need to be receiving Bitcoin for it to matter. And the more Bitcoin you receive every day, every hour, every minute, then the more power you have. So that's one dimension. I mean, there's many dimensions to keeping Bitcoin intact. This is just one. But from that dimension, just running a node doesn't really help anything.
Well, so I'd be curious to understand that a little bit more, because my understanding would be that in the early days, like in the last 2X, probably the Coinbase of the world were like sending and receiving way more Bitcoin than most of those nodes. So is your point that at the time the people were still sending and receiving more than Coinbase or greater?
I don't think that impacted the outcome.
Let me try this. I think a way to think about the point that Steve's making is that you get to decide what is Bitcoin when you accept Bitcoin from somebody, when you receive, right? You say, I accept that. That's Bitcoin because the node I run verifies that that thing happened. You can spend from anywhere. You just have to convince other people that that's valid, right?
Sure.
So it's really whoever it is that's receiving Bitcoin. And if you're receiving Bitcoin for yourself or on behalf of other people, you're defining what is Bitcoin in that act, right? So it's really about the receiving.
That's correct. And let's say I'm running a node, but not receiving, all that node's really doing is just relaying transactions and blocks. And so it is true that it won't relay transactions or blocks that it considers invalid. However, it's just inconsequential because whether that node, you'll just be routed around.
Have we ever seen, I've seen these like maps that I think people have run that try to sort of show how many nodes are running worldwide and where they're running, where the concentration of nodes is. But have we seen anything around like that thing overlaid with receive transactions?
It would be interesting. Well,
that data is not available, right?
There's no way to know which nodes are receiving. Yeah, I guess.
people would have to personally disclose. Yeah, I buy that to a degree, but I also think I do think it's very important that you have people, yes, of course it's better if they're receiving as well, but I do think it's very important that in the same way that like a BitTorrent network works, right? Like the more people are sharing transaction data. So as an example, just to make this easy, if I were trying to decide what's the real Bitcoin and, you know, I had the ability to see, well, you know, whatever, 80% of the network is pointing to this chain versus chain, that at least to me seems like a very valuable metric.
That can be Sybil attack though, which is, the whole reason proof of work exists. And you only need one honest actor. So like, let's say there's only a small portion of the network running what we would consider the valid rules. As long as your node is connected to just one honest actor, you could have seven others or 70 others that you're connected to that are all malicious or trying to change the rules on you. And you would have access to the honest network. Now, it's also going to compare the heaviest weight chain for proof of work. But in terms of, there's different dimensions here, but in terms of the connectivity of the network, you only need one valid path. And if you want to send a transaction, it just needs to be received by at least one miner. It can, so as long as there's a network path to get to that miner, it doesn't matter whether there's 66,000 or 66,001 nodes.
I certainly understand that it'll get propagated. That's not my point. I guess I would need to think more on this, but my point has always been, I totally understand that it would be economic here, maybe even time weighted. To me, it's very interesting that nodes point one way or the other. Now, I get your point that you could Sybil attack that and spin up a whole bunch of new nodes. So maybe there's different ways you could weight that by like, has this node been running for whatever, 10 years or more?
Yeah, I think that would be a dangerous measurement, actually. Because like, if I wanted to attack the network and change the rules and say, these are the right rules, and then I spin up a million instances on AWS, and then I tweet out saying like, look, 95% of the network agrees with my rules. So my rules are the rules of Bitcoin. So similarly, like let's say you're a whale, you have 100,000 Bitcoin, obviously that's a lot of power, but you running a node that's just sitting there spinning but not receiving it, or you obtained 100,000 Bitcoin 12 years ago, it's just sitting there in cold storage. You running a node literally has no impact. Oops. It doesn't like exercise your power at all. To exercise your power, you need to buy or sell Bitcoin. In this case, if you have 100,000, you're probably selling the Bitcoin.
Right.
Would have a lot of power.
Well, of course. If you dump the Bcash chain, that is a big event. That's interesting. I'll need to think a bit more on that. However, then the thing I would be really curious on, is that true that at the S2FX fork, that the economic nodes that pointed towards the Bitcoin chain were transacting less than the exchanges? Because surprise me.
Well, I don't know, but I don't think that had any impact at all. I think people screaming about it had impact.
Like, this is my point. And this is my point when you have tons of individual nodes.
So, yes. So it'll probably take us a year to fully go through the BCAP project, but we'll touch on it. So one of the six stakeholders defined is media influencers, or really just influencers in general. It should probably just be called influencers. So yeah, if you're like a pleb running a node and you're screaming about it on Twitter, you might not even own any Bitcoin. You might not be having any kind of technical impact on the network like I'm describing. Yet you screaming about it could have impact, and that there's thousands of voices that could sway companies.
And this is exactly what I was trying to say. You define it much better. Thank you. And I haven't read all the BCAPs, so I need to, but this is my point, is that, and perhaps one day with Noster and some kind of reputation, this will get even better. But like, if for, as just an example, Law is screaming that, hey, these guys are lying, like, I'm going to look into it. Whereas if some new, whatever, Twitter account with a zero follower Sybil attack just popping up, I'm not going to look into it. But I think the point that I was trying to make is that the more ground people you have monitoring, the more transparency, the easier it is to pull the fire.
Yeah, agreed. Well, and you mentioned monitoring. A type of monitoring are tools that a developer who goes by 0xb10c, that's his NIM, and he's created a series of tools that monitor mining and the like transaction flows and mempools. And so like, for example, one tool he has, which recently discovered something, is around censorship. And so his tool detected a block that was mined that didn't choose the highest fees. Basically, his tool like constructs the block that would generate the highest revenue for the miner, which is the rational economical decision for the miner to do. So if a miner mines a block but that's not maximizing the fee revenue, it calls into question why. Since OFAC, the OFAC list for naughty Bitcoin addresses is a public list, you can see if some of those were excluded that would have created more revenue. And that that was detected in the past week or two with F2Pool. And F2Pool has been caught doing this in the past too. And their founder and CEO says, or I think co-founder and CEO intentionally did that, but then faced repercussions on social media and then walked it back and apparently is now doing it again.
Just to make sure I understand, he's taking, there's an OFAC list of entities that should be censored, and he's
not entities, choosing, but because there's no
address,
there's no notion addresses of entities on Bitcoin, but Bitcoin addresses.
Okay. The OFAC just has a bunch of Bitcoin addresses listed and says, don't ever process transactions from this.
Yeah. For example, like a North Korea, you know, if North Korean hacker stole cryptocurrency and then it became known that those addresses were from that criminal activity, then it would be in the OFAC list.
And then he's taking that list and he's choosing to mine those ones or he's choosing to exclude those ones. He's mining them or he's excluding them to be compliant.
F2Pool is excluding, there's evidence, strong evidence, they've excluded transactions, like censored transactions that were on the OFAC list.
And this can be reconstructed where if you just look at transactions in the mempool and you get like what they're willing to pay to get a transaction included, then it's economically rational to include one of these OFAC sanction lists, but then it doesn't pop up. I didn't realize this guy was doing that, but that's a great example, you know, open source watching.
Yeah. But it's also, so yeah, he's created great tools to look for stuff like this. More eyeballs monitoring it would be good. But again, you don't have to run a node to get the benefit of that tool. And to be clear, I'm not anti people. Like I'm all for the message of like people should run their own node. I just want to be clear that I think it's been, overly stated the power that that gives someone. So I'm just trying to correct the record there.
Just don't LARP.
But I'm still all for, I mean, like it's way more powerful for someone to self custody their coins versus run a full node that has no relationship to their coins.
And I agree with that. But I think the point that I also was trying to make is that having tens of thousands of these watchers, and frankly, like if you're the kind of person asked, I need to run a node, maybe you're not the watchers we need, but like having 66,000 of those lot type people is very important.
Yep. We could wrap this section or sort of transition, move on. Cause I think we had,
two big topics.
Well, I don't know, kind of related to that. What did you want to get to? I don't know. I saw that we touched on 21 million not guaranteed, but we've got this in-kind redemptions thing. And I think there's sort of like a little bit of the recent news that we were talking about yesterday on chat, these two big announcements that feel to me like they kind of dovetail into that. So maybe we can give a brief overview of that. I'm interested to hear your guys' thoughts on that. So the one announcement, let's do first the Bitwise one. So Bitwise runs one of the ETFs, BitBe, one of the Bitcoin ETFs. They also run a bunch of other crypto-related ETFs. And they just announced a new ETF yesterday that is effectively like an index of companies that hold at least 1,000 Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And so if, in a sense, I'd guess it's the way to describe it is it's like, I think gearing to be something like an S&P 500 type index across categories and types of companies. But the only real qualifier is that you have 1,000 Bitcoin. At least that's the qualifier for the initial inclusion. So when you hear about that, what are your thoughts? Is that exciting? Is that going to move markets? What are the upsides, downsides?
I think it's good that they're experimenting with new things. I mean, I think you made the point that if you're just a pure play ETF going against BlackRock, I mean, you can do well, but you know, it's going to be very difficult to ever make substantial progress in that market. I mean, I think you had some very interesting ideas, DK, and perhaps you should expound on those. I think the idea of just doing a Bitcoin standard ETF, I think the value, and Bitcoin standard ETF is, as I recall, the way they define it is like you have at least 1,000 coins. So today that would be obviously MicroStrategy, doing the MicroStrategy all in times 1,000 of the miners, and then people that are doing block strategy, including Block, have a much smaller position in their balance sheet. That would be Block, Tesla, I don't know, some of these other,
Coinbase.
So, I mean, I think the one thing it does do that's good is it perhaps encourages more companies to play the block strategy, which is great. I mean, more companies that start adopting Bitcoin in some way. Do I personally, like when I use a product like that, No, because I either want to go all in, you know, hasta los huevos with MicroStrategy, 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 or, you know, pick the companies I think would do well. So I don't know if there's even demand from the market for it, but I think it's at least cool for getting more CEOs interested.
So do you think some CEOs will adopt the Bitcoin standard, the 1,000 Bitcoin in the treasury just to be included, or is it going to wait till we, I guess you have to have like pretty big AUM.
I mean, I expect ETF to see this year, you know, I was listening, I think Steve, you shared in our chat the new podcast where Checkmate got MicroStrategy pilled. I thought that was excellent. I think he's a really sharp dude. Punter Jeff, the guy he talks with, also very sharp dude. And I think Punter Jeff made the claim that he expects at least 25 players to do MicroStrategy this year. I think that's probably right. I think it's probably higher than that. I think once we get into the bull, people are going to start. And I think, by the way, that's when it starts getting dangerous. Once you've got 100 companies doing MicroStrategy, then that's when, you know, it's probably like red light, maybe time to rotate for a little bit. But if there's 100 that do that strategy or 25 that do that strategy, I would expect, I don't know, an order of magnitude more that say, well, shit, I should at least dip my toes and play the block strategy. Maybe this encourages that.
Yep. Yeah, I would say like the reason to be excited about it is if you sort of look at things like the S&P 500 over the last 10 years, I think, you know, something like you could have gotten basically all the returns by just holding the Magnificent Seven, or like you'd have, you know, sort of done much better if you'd just, you know, sort of done an index of the top seven technology companies. And there's something about kind of the forward thinking innovation nature of that. We sort of exclude laggards, exclude people who are just focused on their business and sort of focus more on people who are, you know, every one of the Magnificent Seven is, you know, has been required to be thinking about the future because they know that they're, you know, in fierce competition. Whereas like most of the 500 are kind of just, you know, turning the crank, doing whatever their business is. And so I think the bull case on this kind of thing is like, if you have a slice of the market of, you know, just knowing that the CEO and board care about Bitcoin enough to hold 1,000, then that probably tells you other stuff about their focus on innovation, their interest in the future, their understanding of kind of a very important piece of the financial ecosystem going forward. And so that's maybe just that itself is like an interesting cut of the world. Now, I don't feel like I'm about to go rush out and allocate to it, but I do think it's, you know, but also don't allocate to the S&P 500. So like, you know, I think if I were considering, I think that's sort of the consideration set to, you know, of the types of things to think about. Higher risk, probably higher volatility, but kind of gets you more broad exposure to businesses that understand Bitcoin. Dave, any thoughts on the thing? Or?
Nothing to add.
Okay.
But you mentioned the in-kind redemption too. We can talk about that. But Max, did you have something first?
Well, I just wanted to say, DK, I thought you had an interesting idea. If you were running an ETF today, what would you be doing? If you were like, oh shit, we need to take on MicroStrategy, how would you do it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, I don't know if there's a way to take on MicroStrategy so directly. I would point out, I think it's interesting through our discussions, by the way, I have a confession to make. I've purchased a MicroStrategy in the last week. I'd never owned any before, but
ooh,
I think
that's a big one. Not financial advice.
But I think our discussions, just learning more about it over the last year, I've gotten more comfortable with what it represents. And I see it more as a traditional financial markets move around the belief of Bitcoin. So I think it's, in a sense, I wouldn't recommend it to anybody until you already are sort of like a Bitcoiner, understand Bitcoin, own Bitcoin in self-custody. I think it's like a very different advanced type of moves, not something that I'd recommend for everybody. But I think once, now that I've studied it quite a bit and we've talked about it a lot, I felt comfortable making a small allocation to it. But I think it's really more like a kind of like the speculative attack against the TradFi system is kind of what grabs me about it. But I think it's interesting that, you know, Saylor is encouraging other people to adopt that. And he's retweeting Marathon because they're adopting that. He's, in a sense, helping his competition also execute the same strategy. I don't think anybody's going to be able to beat him at that game. I think he's going to be probably the largest. It seems hard to catch up to that. But it could be that others of these smaller ones end up building some of the tooling that they would need as kind of, I call them like the baby MicroStrategies. If there's 25 baby MicroStrategies, maybe each of them decide to build software to support what it means to be a kind of levered long Bitcoin technology company. And, you know, maybe those tools or software can be useful to all the rest of the baby MicroStrategies or others who choose to hold Bitcoin as a treasury asset. So I think it's not like, I don't think anybody should like be replaying the MicroStrategy strategy just wholesale. And like, I don't know where that gets you, but it might be an interesting starting point to find new pockets of innovation around that strategy if that is indeed where the traditional financial ecosystem is going.
Sounds like DK is going to be a startup.
Yeah.
So the in-kind redemptions, just really quick on that, what that means right now for people who buy a Bitcoin ETF, they're in what I would call like a tax trap. Let's say they buy Bitcoin at K and then down the road, it's worth 200K. So they have a nice sizable capital gain there. Once they are, you know, go along their Bitcoin journey, they might realize they want to use their Bitcoin. They want to access their Bitcoin. Why would they want to do that? Well, one, they might realize the benefits of self-custody pertain to them. Like when they started the Bitcoin journey, they didn't really know why they would want to do that. They thought it pertained to other people, not them. But at some point, and if you own a Bitcoin ETF, you can't do that. Let's say that there is one of these future chain splits where a fork is created and everyone who owns, if you own one Bitcoin, all of a sudden you have one of each of the coins. Both of which have a market value, and you can, if you don't believe in one or don't like the price of one, you can sell it. You could double down on the other one. You can only do that though if you control access to your keys. Otherwise, you're beholden to the third party holding your coins. And will BlackRock support that fork or not? Your access to it? Will they support it in a time frame to your liking? Unclear. We already know from history in 2017, 2018. Many exchanges didn't support all the forks, and those that did support forks did it in a delayed fashion, in which case a lot of the times the price of that fork declined substantially.
And historically, this has been big money, right? This is not just like a rounding error. This is, you could effectively control
the... I know people who did self-custody in the 2017-2018 era, and they increased their stack 10 to 15% by dumping all the forks and doing so timely. So that's like a substantial win for them.
Okay.
And so, what are other reasons you might want to access your Bitcoin from an ETF? Lava, we've talked about Lava in this show, where you use your Bitcoin as collateral for a loan. Well, what if you want to take out a US dollar loan without counterparty risk? Well, you can do that with Lava, but you can only do it if you have access to your Bitcoin. You can't do it if you only own the ETF. And then kind of what you're alluding to, David, there's already ways with Lightning Network that you can earn a yield on your Bitcoin while still self-custodying it. And there might even be, we've talked about in the show before, other ways to potentially earn yield in the future. All of those are reasons you want to access your Bitcoin and use it. And we haven't even touched on buying, you know, VPN service or buying goods, doing Nostr's apps or all kinds of reasons you might want to use your Bitcoin today. And it's only going to grow into the future. Well, you can't do that with an ETF. The reason I alluded to the tax trap is, let's say that Bitcoin, you bought it at 100K, now it's 200K, you have this big gain. Now you realize you want to use your Bitcoin. To access your Bitcoin, you'd have to sell some or all your ETF and then rebuy Bitcoin, like on Cash App or Coinbase or River or somewhere, and then you can use your Bitcoin. Well, now you're facing a huge tax bill. So that's why I call it a tax trap. Newcomers, I think, will be seduced into that because ETF is the easiest option for them to get going. And they won't yet have the awareness of the mistake or the drawback to what they're with in-kind redemptions. That would be the SEC creates a new rule in which if you own Bitcoin ETF, you can actually withdraw Bitcoin out of it in kind, not have it be a tax event. And then you can self-custody it. You could store it with a third-party custodian, but you'd have access to your Bitcoin to use it.
And I think the reason this is a topic of discussion is, I think, because it was a recent video clip, at least I saw going around with the SEC commissioner saying that, I don't know if it's a political, how that transitions, but I guess part of the incoming administration, that they're open to in-kind redemptions. And that seems to be something that, I don't know, we might expect to see in 2025. So if you do have appreciated ETFs, you don't have to sell them now and take that hit, the tax hit, in order to get native Bitcoin. You can actually hold. And hopefully in-kind redemptions are enabled within the next year sometime. And then you can actually withdraw from the ETF into self-custody.
Yep. And it's unclear to me, what's the probability of that happening? But it's definitely important for everyone to understand that, be aware of it for everyone, including people new to Bitcoin, and just understand the trade-offs with an ETF. I mean, ETF definitely has advantages and benefits, especially for someone new or if it's a retirement account, but you should at least know the trade-offs. And this gets into a much bigger, broader discussion, which maybe we tackle on another show, where we can talk about holistically, how should people think about custodying their Bitcoin, whether it be self-custody ETFs or River, Coinbase, and everything in between? And should you mix it up, have a little bit in different places? I think there's a lot of good advice to share, so we can do that in a future show.
And I don't want to pre-announce your work here, but you sent me something last night to fill out, and I'm wondering, is there a question that you're trying to answer right now?
Yeah, there's two parts to the survey I sent you. One is evaluating the different attack vectors, like the risk of how you could lose your Bitcoin with each solution. So like example risks would be a user error, like you make a mistake and you lose your backup, like you're self-custodying and you've written down these 12 words and you lost. That would be, and then you're in like your hardware wallet fails and then you've lost all your Bitcoin. That would be a user failure. Or it could be government risk, like the government decides to confiscate all the Bitcoin. So if your solution is sort of within their reach, that would be a risk. By far, I think the greatest risk right now is phishing attacks and like North Korean hackers, like remote people not coming, like not a $5 wrench attack, not people breaking into your home. They don't even know who you are. You just show up on some list, like a, you know, like hackers, like you show up on a list because like, you know, hackers steal the Ledger customer database. Now they have this huge list of customers. And then, you know, they try to like put malicious software in the app or they try a phishing attack by sending you SMS and email, tricking you. And these attacks are getting more and more sophisticated. It's not just like idiots fall for it. Like normal people fall for it. There's all kinds of like recent examples of people receiving phone calls, and being tricked. Again, more and more sophisticated attacks. Like they're receiving emails that are from the domain google.com. The person on the phone sounds very legitimate that they're from Google support. And all of a sudden they give access to their Google account. And then boom, you know. So this exercise is like lots of different attacks, different solutions to store your Bitcoin. What's the level of risk for each attack compared to these solutions? I sort of wrote down my own answers. I'm polling a few of my friends who know quite a bit about the different custody solutions to see what they come up with independently. We'll compare. Then we'll have a discussion to see if we can convince, you know, we'll see how close we are. We'll have a discussion, see how close we are after that discussion. And we can certainly share results. And then a second part of that is for different types of people, like a friend or family member comes to you, they can come to you in different situations, like they're brand new to Bitcoin and they want to buy some. How should they store it? Or someone has already been in Bitcoin for a long time and they might have like $100,000 or more. What should they do? And I've gone through that exercise myself as well. And sort of like, here's the advice I would give someone. So I'm just curious what other people are thinking on along those lines. So once we've assembled this data, we can share it here, what we've come up.
One thought I want to share on that, and maybe I do want to move to one other topic that might take a little bit of time, but I definitely want to get your take on it as well. But I mean, maybe it's a hot take, I don't know, but I kind of agree with Leishman a little bit on this. He's put this out there publicly a couple times and agree. Like most random people today that are getting in, honestly, I think the biggest risk is you lose your keys. And like, I'm not saying you shouldn't self-custody. I mean, it's a journey, and over time, the tools get better, things like BitKey or whatever. But like straight up, you know, you told that story, Steve, about a friend that lost all of their stuff with self-custody and phishing and all these things. The reality is if he just kept it in Coinbase, he would have his money today and now he doesn't. And I think that's probably the case for like the vast majority of people at this stage in development. I think spreading it across many places like River, Lock, you know, companies that you have trust in. I'm not sure Coinbase as much, but maybe Coinbase and Kraken and some of those guys seems reasonable. And some amount of self-custody that probably grows over time also seems reasonable. But I think that selfishly though, I would love to hear. I know we've been hinting at mining for some time. I know this will take a bit of time. So given that we have like half an hour left, I've been thinking a lot more about mining as of late. Steve, I know you're very deep in this game right now. I have read some interesting information recently exploring the size of the mining market and thinking about Block and the role that Block is playing there now. I think that's a very underrated, underexplored business line for the company. Maybe to set just a bit of context, you know, when it comes down to mining, the way I think about it as a business is you really, there's two things that really matter. There's the cost of the electricity that you can procure, and then there is the cost and efficiency. So I guess three things of the chips or the miners that you're using. Historically, the people that have done very well in mining, you know, had access to some, say, unfair advantage. And that unfair advantage might be free electricity. In the early days, you're people that just like, you know, kids mining in college dorms, with the college dorms, and they get hit with a $100,000 bill out of nowhere because they're not paying the electricity bill. More people that did that with, you know, free electricity to office spaces. To maybe now you are a sovereign and you have some hydro capacity that's not being used or some wind power that's not fully utilized. You can get free electricity there. So that's one kind of unfair advantage. The other unfair advantage is if you can get ASICs, which are, those who don't know, specific chips that can only do the SHA-256 function for Bitcoin mining. And so in that case, Bitmain has been the major player. I believe, you know, 70-80% of market share, maybe more. My understanding is they have a top tier relationship with TSMC, which is where the foundry where you would actually manufacture the chips, and have historically kept the best chips for themselves, which is how they've been able to make a lot of money mining from that. So you either need some unfair advantage of power or some unfair advantage of chips. Now, Block is coming into the mix and building American-made, well, I guess not American-made, it's still TSMC, but new chips. I know there's a lot there. I personally, while going down that rabbit hole, did not realize that Block has been in the ASIC game for 15 years now, and therefore has the relationships to pull this off, which is amazing. I've also read some reports about the opportunity in this being in the $2-4 billion range, and I think it's probably much more than that. So I would love to start there as a little bit of background. Like, why is Block going into mining? How big does this all get?
Yeah. Block has been, started this project 3.5 years ago or so. And so it's been a long-term investment already. Why is Block entering this market? It's a huge market. It's, you know, many billions of dollars of market. The current run rate for mining revenue right now is $17 billion in a year, with billion with a B. And as you mentioned, Max, there's two cost components for miners that matter, energy and the equipment. And also, while at any given point in time, there might be profit margin for miners, given that there's almost no barriers to entry to becoming a miner, those margins are always going to compress. There's going to be pressure to compress them to zero. So that $17 billion represents like how much money can be made by suppliers to miners. And again, energy and equipment. And it depends on a lot of factors, whether that ratio is 50-50 or 2-1, one or the other. But I think in pretty much any given scenario, I think it's fair to say that 1/3 to 2/3 would be equipment. And correspondingly, 1/3 to 2/3 being electricity. So yeah, even if it's only 1/3, $17 billion, that's over $5 billion market. Now, a Bernstein report recently, some Wall Street analysts looked at this opportunity and were pretty bullish on it. And for Block, they said the TAM, the total addressable market, was 2 to 4 billion. I don't know how they get that number. It seems to me like it's 5 billion plus. So it's a big market. So that's number one reason to get into this. Two is that there's very few players. There's, as you mentioned, Bitmain dominates. Bitmain and MicroBT are something like 95%+ of the market. They're both Chinese manufacturers. So there's not that many. It's highly concentrated. So just simply being another supplier gives you a great opportunity. Being a non-Chinese supplier is a great opportunity because those Chinese suppliers definitely face geopolitical risk, be it the CCP impacting them or the United States government impacting them. In fact, recently there's been reports, I think Blockspace Media came out with a report saying that a lot of Bitmain shipments that are showing up on U.S. shores are just like sitting there. They're not able to reach their destination due to some kind of U.S. regulatory or U.S. injunction or something. So, and there's many other reasons Block got into this. Another one being like Bitmain's customer support and reliability have pretty much universally
not existed,
considered to be quite poor. The one thing Bitmain has done well, they've always been number one in terms of performance of the chips, and they remain number one. So they absolutely do well at that. So they, you know, they deserve their position to date. It's going to be a challenge for any newcomer to compete with that.
Are these really sophisticated chips to build? like the design of these or the build requires like really cutting edge stuff, or is it, I always thought of mining as kind of a little bit dumb in a,
yeah.
I mean, in like the technology sense of it, it's not like the sophisticated NVIDIA GPUs.
I think your understanding is generally true, but even though it's a relatively simple ASIC chip design, when you're dealing with like bleeding edge node technology, like 3 nanometer or soon 2 nanometer, that requires a lot of sophistication. It also just takes tons of money. Like every tape out you do is tens of millions of dollars, and you don't really know you got your design. You can simulate your design, but you don't really know you have it right until you do a tape out and actually produce real chips on wafers. And yeah, I mean, it's taken over 3 years for Block to go from starting at zero to now producing chips. And I don't think it's because Block's slow or dumb. If you look at other examples of companies that have done this,
it's just a process.
Also taken a long time. But definitely you're right in the sense that the algorithm, the SHA-256 based algorithm that Bitcoin uses, one of the reasons it's speculated that it was chosen, and regardless of the motivation for choosing it, a property of it is that it's relatively simple and should lead to commoditization of chips. And I think that's true. But there's other aspects of creating commodity. If you depend on the latest advanced node technology, like 3 nanometer or better, sadly, there's only 2 foundries in the world that can produce that. So boom, you've already concentrated down to 2 foundries. And then each of those foundries depend on one company in the Netherlands for like this lithography tool as part of the process. So there's many layers of centralization there. So Block or no company can solve all of them. But one of them is just having another credible quality supplier to produce and design chips. Another big opportunity is really becoming like a platform. So right now, Bitmain, no other supplier sells chips directly. They only sell rigs. So they're vertically integrated.
And a rig, just to be clear, is a rig is like a rack mounted component that has many chips in it, like many ASICs that are all running. So what are the scale of like,
yeah, a rig would have 100 to 500 chips, say, ASIC chips inside, and cost on the order of thousands of dollars, you know, 1,000 to 10,000, maybe 15,000 per rig. And they can, depend on the operation. But if it's an industrial sized mining farm, it would look much like a data center that Google or Facebook would have. There's thousands of these rigs, all, you know, making a lot of noise, generating a lot of heat. So that's the market today. It's mostly industrial mining. They buy these rigs, but speaking to many mining companies, there's a lot of problems with, there's limitations for like new applications because the current rigs don't fit certain applications. Like if you want to run one at home, or there's like a spa in New York that runs mining and you have to like jury rig the current rigs and mining equipment to even like work in those situations.
I mean, you say
a lot of mining companies,
they're using the heat as part of the spa. Is that what?
Yeah, they're heat. Yep, exactly. They're heating up the water for the spa with Bitcoin miners.
We should do a pod from there.
I'm not sure if people want to see that, but it would be cool. So there's many mining companies that have custom designs for industrial design that they have in mind, but they're really not able to do it. So if you have a supplier that will sell chips directly, and also like provide the data sheets for that and really be as open as possible, it's going to create a whole new market of new applications of mining that weren't really practical historically. So I'm super excited to see that unfold.
Are those mostly going to be new applications around using the heat in a different way, or like building chips into like mining chips into other appliances, or what?
Well,
how do we think about like what that enables?
Concrete example, the first customer that was announced by Block for their chips is a company called Core Scientific. They're a huge miner. They are doing they're an industrial miner, and they're doing custom designs out to create more density of hash rate for like per linear foot. They basically, they're in optimization mode for their data centers. And by buying the chips directly from Block using their own custom form factor designs, they're able to make more efficient use of power supplies, of linear footage. They're also improving maintenance. If one hash board breaks, you can just like hot swap it and you don't have to take everything down. Where my understanding with like Bitmain machines, you just take the whole rig down if one chip or breaks or one board breaks. So things like that. So that's one example. Another would be like the sauna or like heat or, you know, heating your pool at home. But imagine, you know, just the home application. Like, I still believe strongly long term that we will see hundreds of thousands of home miners in use, but there's a lot of things that need to improve to make that realistic. I mean, starting with noise and having noise reduction, and then unwanted heat, and whether you dissipate that by heating your pool or dissipate it some other way. But those are two things. You also need to make it turnkey, like simple and maybe even beautiful. You know, something that's visually appealing, kind of like what Nest did and Tesla Power. Mm-hmm. I don't know if people would call them beautiful, but they're at least not ugly. Like if you take something like industrial equipment and put your home, it's ugly. So like at least not ugly, if not beautiful. So all those things could be done. And then like an app or, you know, like a nice consumer interface. So all those things would need to be done. And then you also need to get the economics right as well. But yeah, so I think there's lots of opportunity by just selling a chip directly.
And one of the things I'm interested in is, you know, and to be clear, I think all that you guys are working on is open source, which is awesome. At least the, well, I don't know what all is open source and what's not, but the ability to experiment with miners in more form factors, that's clearly going to increase. And I think one of the interesting trends we've been thinking, well, something I've been thinking about as an investor for many years now, is where is the money actually going to be made here, right? So the public miners, I'm kind of bearish on because, you know, they're just going to compete, I think, away a lot at the margin. If you have access to TSMC and you have access to interesting chip designs, pretty bullish on that, which is what Block has. But I'm also very interested in new models. For example, Kian from Stacker News shared this in a chat with us. This is an idea that I've been thinking about for 5 years or something now. And it's very interesting to see someone finally do this. Oh, whoa, that popped up in the chat. I saw a nice DK. You got a nice little effect there. This is, I don't know how you say this, Enadro. I don't even know who this is, but the idea is it's a very similar model to the company that I, you know, I guess helped start many, many years ago, which is basically residential solar finance, but they're just including miners in there. And the idea is that if you size it correctly, you can potentially make this more profitable. Over time, by the way, as we see, to your point, Steve, if you're an industrial miner, you have to compete, you know, ideally with two unfair advantages, really cheap power and the latest and greatest chips. However, the old, you know, whatever, 9-millimeter chips or whatever, those can still be profitable if you have essentially free electricity in the case of, you know, a wind farm that's dissipating 30% of its power. A company like Satoshi Energy, you know, they make their money in essentially brokering or market making between these free or negative sources cost of power and old chips. So, you know, the 15 nanometer can even still be profitable if it's already fully depreciated and the energy is free or negative cost. Great. So I think over time, one thing I'm really excited about is, and especially if these chips are widely available and the applications and the platform on top of it is easy to experiment with, I want to see chips everywhere. So in your solar inverter, like literally in the inverter itself, you know, I expect to see this one day. I expect to see Tesla go big on this for their both industrial applications, but also for things like Powerwall and the way they size their solar and Powerwall systems together. They'll probably be the one to really knock that out of the park. Maybe even in the Tesla themselves, you'll have some of these chips. We're probably a ways away from all that, but you know, the easier it is to play with these chips, the cheaper they get, the more you'll see that kind of stuff.
Yep, I agree. We have an audience question here.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Can we do the audience question real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks. So L asks, when would Block have a ready-made product to buy and what? What would be the cost? What might be the expected yield per year? So don't really have answers to any of that. As I mentioned, and there's just nothing to share right now in terms of that, but I can speak to generalities. The one customer deal was already publicly announced. And I think next year you can expect to see mass production of the chips and actual deployment. I would expect that to be initially with industrial type mining. That's where the market is today. That's the multi-billion dollar market today. That doesn't mean new applications aren't interesting, but they're currently like market size of basically zero and will need to grow over time. So I think Block's interested in new applications, including home miners, but it's just like a more of a long-term play. And then secondly, you know, does Block need to create those home miners? Maybe, maybe not. Again, I see this as a platform play where there could be new startups and other companies creating awesome home mining solutions, sauna solutions, whatever, different pool heating solutions, lots of different solutions. They can buy the chips, they can do it. And so it doesn't have to come from just one company. And then as far as the cost, you know, nothing specific to share there. But again, I think the way that like an industrial miner calculates that and views that is probably going to be very different than like a individual who's buying it for the home. So I think that the answer would be quite elaborate for an industrial miner, the way they go about thinking. Think of it for a retail user like any of us, you know, you want to know, is it going to be $99 or $4.99, et cetera. But while I can't, you know, I think we'll see price points at all kinds of a variety of price points, because again, historically, you could only buy a Bitcoin or a Bitmain rig that had like 300 ASIC chips in it. And so your price points say $3,000. But when other companies can buy just the chips, one company can put just like 20 ASIC chips on it. And, you know, they can put just enough chips on it to reach the $99 price point. And someone can have the $299 price point and the $799. So we'll have a variety of price points, you know, all of which or any of which could make sense for different customer segments.
One big question, I think it's a good follow-up to that, is how you guys see hash rate increasing over time versus other HPC or like AI compute. One interesting trend is we've seen some of these quote unquote industrial miners, companies like Crusoe, which has just raised, I think, like a couple weeks ago, a new massive round from Founders Fund, and so now multi-billion dollar valuation. You know, a lot of other, I don't know if it was Mara, Marathon, or a few others that are increasingly becoming high performance compute versus Bitcoin mining. So I totally hear and agree with you, Steve, on the short run. Obviously, you know, industrial is where it's going to be at. How do you guys think, though, in the next couple of years, Bitcoin mining versus AI compute goes? Obviously, there's going to be more electricity demand, period. And over time, do you sort of see that shifting away from the industrial, where like, look, if you're like large scale, probably you're doing HPC compute, unless it's intermittent power, like with solar or wind, and that more of this, like, you know, very diversified, spread out car solar inverters becomes where Bitcoin mining plays its role? Or do you see it differently?
Let me first say, just to you, I heard you say you guys a couple times. I just want to be clear to the audience, my role at Block. So I'm in charge of Spiral. We work on open source Bitcoin software. I'm not in charge of the Block mining business or product roadmap. It's a separate team. So anything I say here is a combination of public information, and just my own personal views on the mining space. I do know quite a bit about the mining space. But it's, you know, so I'm not like an official representative of the Block mining strategy. So having said that, so what are my views on that? I don't see how hash rate would be impacted by AI. So,
well,
help me understand.
It's all competitive, right? So it's like not only existing hash rate, but future growth hash rate. Like, you know, it's not entirely zero sum because we're building a lot of new electricity. But as an example, Crusoe started purely as a Bitcoin miner from stranded methane gas that was essentially being burned in turbines. Over time, they've pivoted much more focused on HPC or AI compute because they can get much higher prices for that. So I don't know. It's harder, much harder to track the metrics for the AI compute landscape because a lot of that's, you know, not public. You hear Amazon, for example, signing old nuclear plants back into commission. I don't know what they actually pay for that. I've heard some people say they'll pay any price. Now, there's a bunch of other caveats you have to add into this discussion that make it much more sort of sophisticated, which is, for example, you know, for AI compute, whether that be for training models or inference, you know, typically you can't have that be intermittent. So for example, if you have excess solar or wind power, you can't just have it running and then, oh, you turned off and no big deal, where you can for mine.
I think that maybe the difference, I mean, we can analyze one company and like what their distribution looks like over time and then the whole network, but I still don't see how the overall network's hash rate is a function of AI at all.
Well, I'm not saying it's a total function, but I'm making the point that for every new kilowatt that comes onto the grid, that can be routed to many different places based on markets. So if AI will pay higher, it goes to AI. If Bitcoin will pay higher, it will go to Bitcoin. And, you know, whatever, a consumer use case will pay higher, it goes to that. So as electricity generation as a total grows, which is going to continue to do, markets are going to dictate which way it goes. So my point is, where do you make more money, in AI or Bitcoin mining? And my guess is we're looking at, say, 700x hash per second right now. My guess is that would probably be even higher if AI had not spiked so much in the last 2 years, because that drew some amount of electricity away from
it. Yeah, I don't think I agree with that, because there's a lot, AI is not sucking up the rest of the world's electricity. So if there's profits to be had in mining, hash rate's going to come online. Now, there might be latency. Like if the price of Bitcoin in the next week goes from 100K to 200K, it's not like the mining can instantly respond to that and generate twice as much equipment for hash rate. So there would be latency there. And same with electricity. I mean, you have to like sign a deal and you have to acquire the electricity, sign a deal.
Exactly.
So there's latency, but like the market forces will lead to sucking up that profit margin that exists because there's no barrier to entry. Like any new entrant can see there's profit to be had in Bitcoin mining. So I'm going to use this electricity to mine.
Totally.
Well, independent of AI.
Yeah, no, but I think perhaps I don't understand what you're sort of concerned that argument. Because to me, it's very clear, and I've seen this like even some of my own companies, you know, you have, for example, power plant, and there's, you know, an RFP, and they say, we can use this excess electricity generation for any number of things. Before the giant AI boom, the amount per kilowatt hour that HPC compute was willing to pay was much lower. And so in some of those cases, and by the way, in a Bitcoin bull market, the cost per kilowatt hour that Bitcoin mining is going to pay is probably going to go up a lot. But those two things are in competition. Now, to be clear, you can always build new electricity generation and you can pair some of those things together and, you know, change your mix. But in my experience, the companies I've seen over the last, say, 18 months, I've seen companies that were entirely focused on procuring power for Bitcoin miners begin to shift and take some of that load and move it into AI compute.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, in a sense, it's a competitive world and competitive market, and there's a lot of forces playing here, but I don't know the one necessarily, like with the growth of the ability to acquire energy resources in lots of ways, it could get directed one way or the other, but probably not as kind of fiercely competitive on a minute by minute basis as, you know, maybe like a theoretically perfect model might assume.
Right. Well, and I do think we're going to get there. But to be clear, I'm not even saying it's on a minute by minute. My broader point is, I mean, if you guys know me or anyone's heard me talk before, I'm as bullish on solar and electricity generation as is humanly possible to be. And again, there's like different requirements for mining versus HPC. But in general, my view is that you've seen demand, like the cost for HPC pulling new energy generation into existence, or, you know, back into existence in the case of some of the nuclear stuff, and certainly new, you know, power plants are getting built a lot in the last 18 months with that power spike, less so than Bitcoin did maybe back in 21 when there was a bull market. Think in this bull market, as you see the total like dollar denominated cost coming back to miners going up a lot, I think you're going to see a lot more demand for energy companies integrating Bitcoin mining. But bullshit.
Go ahead.
Real quick, if we're going to stay on this topic, one more thing to add. I mean, I think this also creates great opportunity for like other jurisdictions around the world. So if the contention around the resources you're talking about, Max, are predominantly like in big, electrical energy production bases in the US, then, you know, there's going to be like gridless in Africa that is going to be able to do more business in like remote jungles of Kenya, because the profit margins will be larger. So it becomes more profitable, more people are going to want to do it. So I think that's why, in my mind, it'll find a way around the world. If there's profit margin to be had, it's so decentralized, lacking any kind of barriers to entry, that it'll find a way. And in fact, that would be a great thing if there's less concentration of Bitcoin mining in the US due to AI.
No, and to be clear, I totally agree with that. Sorry, guys, I have a helicopter. In fact, I mean, that's what Bitcoin mining, I see it as, it's the buyer of last resort for electricity. And I also expect to see what's going to happen a lot more is that you'll see Bitcoin mining as a temporary solution, and then potentially long, like, because you can spin it up so quickly to help finance more longer term solutions. Like, for example, if you want to build an off-grid solution that eventually gets connected to the grid, Bitcoin mining could be the solution for the first several years that then helps underwrite connecting it to the grid. I agree. It's always going to be the sort of, the bottom feeder, if you will. I'm just curious over the next, let's say, decade, if we look at hash rate, so to speak, like total kilowatt hours going to AI growth versus total kilowatt hours going to Bitcoin growth. I'm going to be very curious to see how those two curves form.
Do we have any data right now about how the Bitcoin mining ecosystem is getting kind of further decentralized and looking for more of these sort of, you know, enabled by these sort of low cost, maybe stranded energy resources versus how much it may be getting further centralized by, I think, Steve, at one point we were talking about how maybe the Texas energy grid has a closer coupling with Bitcoin mining today than before. So there's some regulatory participation there. Are we generally on a trend toward more centralization for now or more decentralization or it just in sort of mining and hash power?
I've not seen credible data for several years now in terms of geographic distribution of mining. So that would be valuable to see.
It would be. I mean, from just like some of the sources that I've seen can gather, I mean, Texas is obviously dominated since the China ban. And the reason for that is because ERCOT, Texas electricity grid, is completely deregulated. And so you have a lot more opportunities for all kinds of things. Having said all that, this is a topic that I was broaching with Andrew Myers, Satoshi Energy CEO, when we had our podcast a little bit. You know, you still have gigawatts of solar and wind that are not able to get approved today in the Texas, let's say, backlog that are waiting to get built. And my guess is you're going to figure out some way, maybe, you know, I don't know, the next 4 years, to build a lot more solar there, like a lot. To do that, though, you need some governmental help. You need like either permitting, you know, reformation. You need potentially HVDC, high voltage DC transmission lines. Or you need the cost of Bitcoin or HPC to be so high that you can still justify building off grid first. But my understanding is Texas is still by far the dominant.
And in terms of the chip sourcing and mining, I think I heard, Steve, when you were talking about the chips, is it that the chips today come from Bitmain primarily, but was there a second one that you mentioned?
BT.
Okay. And do they, I know that Bitmain does their own mining still, right? Does MicroBT also run their own mining?
I have no idea if either of them do their own mining. I mean, there's rumors that Bitmain's done that historically, but I don't know if we actually know that. I mean, I think we have strong suspicion that's true. I don't know if we actually have facts that is true or evidence, and I don't know if they do it now.
Because one of the big innovations I could see is just sort of separating who creates the chips and sells them versus who operates the mining, and sort of keeping those more separated probably leads to more transparency and incentives, which could be another factor we get from sort of a, you know, Block entering as a larger scale chip provider.
Yeah, I would expect if Block were to self-mine, that would be, the company would be transparent with that. And if they're selling used equipment, they would state it as such and not trick people. But I'm personally a little, yeah, I think it's great to be picks and shovels in the space and sell the chips. And that's like, will be a hugely profitable business as long as the chips meet some minimal performance bar, which doesn't have to be as high as Bitmain. It just needs to be in the ballpark because there's a lot of other factors. It needs to hit a minimum bar. Being a miner, even with some cost advantages, is still risky. And so unclear if that's a good business to enter.
But even with the changes, usually when there are changes in the technology platform, like we're seeing with, you know, going from rigs to chips, there's maybe new opportunities. Do you suspect that like this could be a wedge that would enable new miners with a sort of different capital structure, different real estate plan, different sort of cooling system? Would it enable new miners to compete, or is it more, it's just going to enable sort of new use cases, but not kind of the scalable kind of like the mining, the corporate mining stuff that we have?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt any new application of mining that needs a custom form factor and thus gets enabled by being able to just buy individual chips, that's going to create whole new markets, and it would be a good business for the manufacturers making that equipment and even the miners, because they'd be the first movers. Whether that's like a good long-term business, I think I'd call that into question for any miner, because uh-huh. It's a zero sum. The profit margins for the industry, in theory, should always converge to zero. So you need a sustainable cost advantage on the equipment, the energy, and or the financing in order to be profitable long-term.
Cool. I see we are at the end and we wanted to try to wrap on time today. So can we call it a wrap now, or do we have any other final words, wishes for a happy new year? 2025.
Do crazy predictions now, or save that for another episode?
Steve, you got any crazy predictions?
I don't have any ready. I was asked at some gathering my price prediction of Bitcoin, which I don't like making price predictions. I don't believe I possess such power, but I think I did say K by the end of the year, and this is like November 19th. So maybe that will ring true.
I'll have to add on that. I mean, obviously, price predictions are the least interesting thing. However, if the simulation plays out as Elon seems to suggest, well, the most interesting, funniest outcome is the one that happened. Last bull market, we touched 69K or 20 incoming in 2025.